Thanks so much for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Go ahead and take a look at weather and climate with our weather guys. Well, we've got our weather guy with us, right? Steve Ackerman, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the UW-Madison. He have one of his jobs. He's got a lot of jobs.
A lot of jobs. As we all do.
So it's great to have him back. And here's a question for you. Could your next cell phone purchase interfere with weather forecasting? That's something that they can talk with us about, one of among several things. Likely it seems that seasonal weather patterns are shifting, what weather we might see at this winter. We can talk about that. And using 5G wireless, could that impact weather forecasting? So climate weather questions, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And one of the things we always like to see are your photos. Weather photos are always great. Sometimes people say, well, what kind of a cloud formation is this? Or here's an interesting tornado that I took a picture of while I was running the other way. Anyway, you can email us those as well at ideas@wpr.org. Well, Steve, it's good to have you here. This whole business about a 5G. We had some calls last time you were on about 5G and how that might affect weather reporting. We didn't have enough time really to address it. So let's talk about it now. First, maybe just what is 5G?
Yeah. So, yeah, this is a battle that's coming up with the FCC and NOAA. So weather and telecommunications. So right now, most telephones are on 4G and 5G is looking to use a different frequency to transmit information. So information now, you know, many, many years ago, it was radio waves, television waves, and now they're using microwaves in regions in the atmosphere which are fairly transparent. And so 5G is proposing to use 24 gigahertz, so that's a frequency. And the reason why they want to go there is that at that frequency, they can pack more information into that frequency as they transmit it. So they can increase the 4G communications by, they claim, up to a factor of 100 or so. So it'll be a lot faster. So you can see the value from the FCC. Now, the downside is that for the weather, at 23.8 gigahertz, so not very far from 24, water vapor emits energy. And we use satellite, and it's not a lot of energy, but it's enough that satellites can detect it. And so we can tell the amount of water vapor distributions in the atmosphere, which plays an important role in forecasting precipitation, which is one of the harder things to forecast.
Ooh.
And so there's concern is if you go to the 24 gigahertz, since water vapor is right at 23.8, that there'll be leakage into that, and then we'll lose those water vapor signals. And it could significantly deteriorate our weather forecasts, taking us back 10, 15 years.
Ouch.
Times. Yeah. So you can see how they're battling, right? On both sides, there's advantage, but we fall on the weather side.
Well, 23.8, right?
Yeah.
Versus
24. Yep.
Couldn't they just go to 23.8, or is that?
Well, if they go to 23.8, then they're right in the water vapor, and then you mess up the signal.
Oh.
And so that's why even at 24, if they're not exactly at 24 and they leak a little bit in, then the satellites will be saying, oh, yeah, there's a lot of water vapor in here, and that's going to transport, and that's going to change the forecast in a non-realistic way.
Yeah. So how's that going to unfold? I mean, are there decision deadlines and so forth?
I don't know of any decisions. It's been going on now for at least a year and a half. I think actually the FCC may have actually gigahertz, because that's the we own that. And now they and so I think it's now I'm remembering it's at the international level. Because this sharing weather data is a global phenomenon, and many countries cooperate. And so, you know, other countries use those frequencies to measure water vapor for their own forecasting. And so if the U.S. is you know, at using 5Gs and messing up their signal, then it messes their forecast. And then if we're going to use it, then will Europe use it for 5G? And so it's a complicated political policy.
All kinds of things going on there. Are there, just thinking about it, are there other technologies that have affected your work negatively or positively?
There was a few years ago, maybe a decade or two, there was a 410 gigahertz, I think it was, or megahertz. Again, that got sold off for communications, and it was used on ground-based instruments to measure wind speed. So they had this new technology, measure wind speed at a radio antennas, or not antenna, radio, but these antennas that all had to be closed up because the interference was too great and you couldn't get any good data.
So what did they do?
They took down the towers. And they found another way to measure winds. When you lose, you lose.
Wet your finger and put it up in the air.
You put it up in the eye, right? You just got to see how bad it is outside.
Oh, man. You can join in, too, by the way, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dawn from Madison emailed to say it seems like we have more gray, cloudy days than clear, sunny days, especially noticeable this winter. Is it just me, or is it global climate change playing a part in it? And if so, why?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. And what I'm thinking of is we don't get quick updates on cloud cover.
Mm-hmm.
But I know in the temperature for all of Wisconsin, we've been above average. And southern Wisconsin's been 4 or 5 degrees above average. And one way to get that average, both daytime and nighttime. And so one way to keep the nighttime up is to get increased cloud cover. And then that kind of keeps things warm. So I wonder if it has been more cloudy these last couple of weeks in particular, where we've gotten a bunch of little snow flurries. Like, again, in southern Wisconsin this morning, we got some more snow flurries because it's cloudy out, which means it's cloudy out. We're getting snow, typically.
Yeah, you don't have to. If you see the snow coming down, you know it's cloudy.
You know it's cloudy. Unless it's diamond dust. That's another special.
Diamond
dust, which occurs at really cold temperatures. So
what's
they see this
dust?
Frequency in Antarctica. So what happens is it gets so cold that the water vapor in the atmosphere just spontaneously starts to form ice crystals. They grow really long, and you get this when you shine a light or if the sun comes up in Antarctica, you get this scintillating effect in the atmosphere. Everything, the atmosphere is sparkling because you have these long ice crystals that they call diamond dust.
And by long, we're not talking long.
No, we're not talking a foot. But I think they can get up to a millimeter in size.
Okay.
So that would be visible if it landed on your jacket for sure. But yeah, I wonder if we've been just cloudy and so it's seemed gloomy, particularly these last couple of weeks. We've got a lot of cloudy conditions and a lot of snowfall on and off, you know, little bits.
Is that unusual? I mean, the snow on and off the way we've gotten it, is that?
It's frustrating, I know, because it's been heavy snow too. So shoveling my driveway has been a pain.
Yeah.
But a lot of times you'll get a big snowfall and then you'll get a break and it'll get sunny. But these last couple of weeks, you know, we've been getting some snowfall and then maybe it warms up to 30 something and then that's going to be foggy and then another little system comes in and gives us another inch or so.
Yeah. Boy, this is kind of the time of the year when winter starts to feel
long.
It's never ending for some people. But there does seem to be some variation on when our winter weather starts and ends in a given year. What affects how long a winter weather season we get?
Oh, boy. I think part of it is going to be psychological, for one. I think if you think back to early November, remember it was really cold early November. Right. And I think everybody was like, oh, no, this is going to be a really bad winter. So I think that's part of it. The other thing we'll look at, and we'll see this in climate records as well, is you pick a temperature of when is the last 32 degrees, the last day in which it hit 32 degrees or lower. And then we'll look at that. And that's going out further into the springtime that it has in the past, which is an indication that winters are warming up.
Joe in Jefferson has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hey, guys. My question is, you know, many times when you hear the conspiracy people talk about there's spraying going on from jet planes and the fuel to control, you know, the climate and whatnot. They do sometimes, you know, people that even make crazy claims have dots of facts. I always like to say the dots don't connect. But one of their facts they claim is that the scientific community has admitted, at least someone like the expert you have on now might know about it, that there's some technology, at least that they admitted does exist, not that it's happening on this global level like they're claiming, that there is something, maybe the aluminum or barium that they've tested to try spraying something in the air that would deflect the sun's rays or whatever. Does it really, is there some truth to these claims that, you know, people that believe in this conspiracy might have some truth, even though obviously you're not going to agree that the conspiracy is real, but is there at least a little truth to it?
So there's a couple of things. One is changing weather patterns is really, really hard to do that intentionally just because of the amount of energy that one would need to change a particular event. One would argue, and I'd certainly argue this, we have changed the weather unintentionally by changing the climate. And we've done that by increasing CO2 into the atmosphere. There has been efforts of cloud seeding, so trying to get clouds to precipitate, particularly with snowfall in the mountains. And I think that I don't think it's really proven right or wrong. The other thing you're mentioning with regard to putting particles in the atmosphere is geoengineering. So there has been proposals to put things in the upper stratosphere to reflect solar energy to offset global warming. But, you know, I think you're doing stuff where we don't really know what we're doing. So it's a little dangerous. But there is a whole report now coming out and looking at that issue of geoengineering.
And we can talk some more about geoengineering and other weather climate things with our two guests. John Martin will be with us pretty quick now. Steve Ackerman with us right now. And they'll both be back after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network, taking a look at weather and climate with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, both professors, homed in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And, of course, whenever they're on, we'll take any kinds of weather questions. So what's on your mind? Are you curious about changing weather patterns, a recent weather event? Join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And again, if you've got a weather photo you want us to see and maybe comment on, you can email it that as well to ideas@wpr.org. And Christina in Glenwood City has phoned in and has a question. So let's go there. Christina, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thank you. I am delighted to speak to you. A dear friend passed away. During his burial, we looked to the sky and saw a beautiful, vibrant, halo-shaped rainbow, an actual ring. Have you seen this?
With the sun in the middle?
I guess I can't say the sun was in the middle. We just saw a beautiful halo-shaped ring, very thick and vibrant.
And it wasn't during the day, right?
No rain whatsoever. It was just a lovely day.
You know, I've seen something similar to what I think you're describing. It's called a tangential arc. And usually it's really bright because the sky is typically blue. And then there are ice crystals up in the atmosphere as part of a very thin cirrus cloud that might be hard to see. And then as the rays from the sun enter into those ice crystals, they bend, much like a crystal in a window, those lead crystals you put in. And that causes the colors to separate out and form an arc-type structure. And in those situations, I was initially wondering about a halo that it actually is centered around the sun. And those are usually very more whitish in colors. But this other one is very distinct in terms of the colors separating out.
Yeah, and it's away from the sun.
And it's away from the sun.
So you don't, it doesn't get washed out.
Yeah.
It doesn't get washed. Yeah.
And they're very rare. I've only seen one once, and I'll tell you, I look up in the atmosphere a lot trying to see these things. So pretty special.
Pretty special. You were lucky, Christina. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Madeline from Green Bay called. She couldn't hang on, but wondered if you'd heard of Volkswagen using weather-altering technology in Mexico. We were talking about altering the weather just before our news break. They used hail cannons that shot sonic booms into the air to prevent the formation of hail. Farmers accused them of affecting rain patterns and damaging crops. Have you heard about that?
I didn't hear about it in Mexico, but I know they've done it in the Central Plains, particularly back in the 50s, in terms of trying to stop large-scale hail from forming. But then it generates the question, and this is what's happening in what she's saying in Mexico, is that, okay, if you don't make it hail here, there's still a lot of water in those clouds. And so what happens downwind of the area you're trying to modify? And again, I don't think there's been, in fact, I'm certain there's never been any scientific evidence that it actually worked.
No, I think some of this sound
stuff. I think some people got rich.
Yeah, they did. And it started as in somewhere in southern Europe, I think. Southern France is right about 1850 or northern Italy. They used these big sound cannons and professed that they were stopping hail. But it's impossible to make that discernment. So, I think it's all hocus pocus.
And I wonder if that sound was associated with back in those days and even, well, certainly back in those days in wars. A lot of time there would be rain following wars. And whether that was coincidental or this, not so much the sound, but the
smoke.
The smoke and stuff.
Yeah, right.
Aerosol going in. So tons of aerosols in a big battle.
Yeah, very interesting.
I don't know if anybody's ever actually looked at that.
It's a good question.
Big battle. Did it rain?
Yeah, right.
Or is it just memorable because it did rain and then changed the outcome
of
the battle?
Right, so it's a select small number of events, but they have a high profile.
Right, yeah.
I don't know.
Well, June, I believe, is from Green Bay and with us next. So let's go to June in Green Bay. Hi, June.
Hi, and hi to those weather guys. I'm anxiously waiting for their answer, and they probably have answered it before, but I must have missed it. I'm wondering why the northern part of the United States has so many overcast days compared to the southern part. Having come back from Florida recently where it was sunny every day, why do we have so many overcast days?
Well, that's a good question, June. And shame on you for coming back from Florida.
I bet you like winter job.
It's a great question. And it really, one large component of the answer, it might not be the whole thing, but one large component of the answer is that the storm track, the track that extratropical storms take across the continental United States, is at higher latitude throughout the year. And it's especially true in the wintertime. And so that fact means that all the organized weather systems get themselves put together at higher latitude, and weather systems come with cloud shields. And to the south of the active storm track is usually an area where the air is gently subsiding a little bit. And that can ensure, on the other side, that the sky remains more likely clear than places to the north. So it's a really good observation, and it's right on. Mm-hmm. And that's one big part of the answer.
And it's one reason why people go to Florida in the wintertime.
On the other hand,
I went to Georgia, Atlanta, the day after Christmas, and it rained every day. We were down there almost every day. Well, back here, the temperatures were
nice,
even a degree or two higher.
Well, they were complaining. I think I heard too. They're complaining that an overnight low in Atlanta was 22. This is just intolerable. But it's funny that if you're in the panhandle of Florida, if you spent time there, you might not have the same impression. If you're in the peninsula, it makes a world of difference. It's amazing. Just a few miles makes a big difference at those latitudes.
Well, thanks again for that call. Let's take another call. Bonnie and Shell Lake will turn to you next. Hi, Bonnie.
Well, good morning. I don't know if I am in the right department. So I'm a I'm an older person, and when we were growing up, we had cousins that lived way up northwest of Cumberland, and there were a lot of public lands or lands owned by forest companies, so it was fairly remote up there. And my cousins and I would walk through the woods, and this was in the wintertime, there'd be big globs of, it looked like tinsel, that had been dropped from airplanes. And my cousin said, yeah, they'd seen that a bunch before.
Hmm.
And there, you know, it was all spread out. So I don't know, A, if this was a weather-related thing, that they were testing something in the atmosphere, or was this part of the Cold War? I have no idea what this was.
Very interesting. I know there was a time, even as late as the 1970s, where once in a while you'd see on a radar display, or maybe in the 1980s now, I have to say that, because I was a student at the time, where someone would say, that's just chaff.
Yeah.
They'd be testing a new radar. So it's possible that's what was going on in that instance. There's also, I know, in World War II, the British and the Germans developed this technology, radar jamming technology, that was very simple. And they both hesitated for a year to use it because they thought it was so powerful. It's just little pieces of tinfoil on paper that would bounce all the radar energy away, and they couldn't spot aircraft. And so it might have been something like that, another higher profile version of something like that, some experimental thing they're trying to test out. It's quite possible.
Yeah, interesting.
And I'm trying to remember, I can't think of the name of it now. There was a system, a grid system in the ground that was built in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah. What, really? For communications.
It was covering
submarines, I think. Yeah.
Covering several miles. Yeah. So that we would always be able to have contact with subs.
Right.
And other,
it'll come to me. The name's on the tip of my tongue.
Wow. Somebody
they closed
knows.
It down about maybe in the 90s or something.
Yeah, they might have closed it down in the 90s.
Yeah.
Whoever's listening, I can remember the name of it.
Wow.
Please call in and let me know because now it's driving me crazy.
Yeah, it's driving me. I was up there when we first moved here in the late 80s.
I can't think of the name of it. Well, give me a call. Yeah. Give us a call if you can remember the name of it. Or maybe it'll come to me. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call for that or any other question that you might have as well.
Yeah.
It's on the tip of my tongue. I just can't think of it. Mike in Racine, let's go to you. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Yes, I have two questions. I realize Lake Michigan is significantly above sea level, like 500 feet. Yet, are there any implications for rising sea level with Lake Michigan? And the second question is the eastern side of Lake Michigan more prone to storm damage with high water than the western side of Lake Michigan?
With regard to the first one, the increasing sea level won't have an impact, right? Because even if it's going to increase rivers with regard to the Great Lakes and getting to Lake Michigan, it's got to get over the Niagara Escarpment.
Mm.
And so that's 800 feet or something like that.
It's pretty
high. So it's not going to get up there directly. With regard to the east versus the west, I would guess, since most weather systems travel west to east, that it would be more of an impact on
the
east
than
on the west.
Yeah, I would think so, too.
Because for one reason, as the winds go over the lake, they'll pick up because there's less friction. So you'll have more wind speed.
Yeah, and you probably have a depression, a divergence of the surface water on the western shore, which might cause a slight depression in the surface level. Not be the opposite in the east, like you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so that's our guess.
And I was reading in the, I don't know if it was the State Journal or the Washington Post, but it was someone living along Lake Michigan that they're actually tearing their house down. Took their house down. Might have been the State Journal, Wisconsin State Journal, where they're actually, because it was going to fall into the lake, so they've tore it down and they're, I don't know if they're moving back. I forget what they're doing, but man, oh man.
Yeah, the erosion's been bad on the Great Lakes this last couple of
years. Somebody called in and said it was Project ELF.
ELF, right, of course.
And I've something.
The last one is frequency, enhanced. Right.
I can't remember what the rest of it was, but Project ELF. And that was a really extensive. I mean, there
It covered a lot of property in a natural forest area, I think.
Yeah. So that,
man, I got to tell you, I'm a little uncomfortable. You guys talking about classified information.
Type in Project Elf sometime, and it'll pop up, and you'll get all kinds of good information about it. You can join in too. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our system is system is kind of down a little bit, so I'm always it's a kind of a guessing by gosh about who's coming up next. So you can join in and we'll find you. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the weather we've been having and how it compares. John, you want to?
Sure, I'd love to talk about that. Today is the 26th, right, I think? 27th, yeah, 27th. So we're about 4 days shy or 3 days shy of our all-time anniversary of our all-time minimum temperature, minus 37 in 1951, which is January 30th or 31st.
Wow.
We're never going to see that this year, not at the same time frame anyway. And it was a year ago right now that we were getting ready for the really deep freeze of the mid-minus 20s across the southern part of the state and colder to the north. And that's not happening. Yeah. Yeah, so this year has been really strange. The whole hemisphere is the second warmest winter up to January 25th that we've had in the last 72.
Really? Second warmest?
Yeah. And it's got a hill to climb to be 2014-15, but it's not impossible. So we might be the warmest winter of all time. Northern hemisphere, not just regional. So the whole hemisphere has been convulsing in a weird paroxysm.
And the state's been 4 to 5 degrees above normal temperature as well.
Right.
We had, and night.
Was it the first half of November was chilly with the snow at the end?
Yeah, right.
And that's
remember
been
that?
It. Yeah.
I was so worried about winter, knowing that there's no connection, but still.
But the snow, the amount of snow hasn't been, at least in southern Wisconsin, has it been as
We're great? A little bit below normal in southern Wisconsin, and northern Wisconsin's above normal.
I think they're well above,
quite a bit. I think they're almost twice what they normally get.
Yeah. The snow belt's had a good year.
Yeah, right.
If you like snow, many people's economy depends on it in some ways.
Right.
They have. So they
well, it's kind of hard, you know, think about, well, climate change, what does it all mean? It's such...
I think there's so many different things. We're just talking about this, you know, erosion of the shore of Lake Michigan. If you have a more consistent series of winters where there's no substantial ice on Lake Michigan, you're going to have more erosion, you'd think.
Because the waves are moving.
Yeah, right. And there's one way to put the kibosh on the waves is to put a sheet of ice on top. And or even barriers of ice out in the middle of the lake that kind of level them a little bit. So there's all manner of little manifestations of it, and with high-profile damage in their wake. One of the things that people talk about from the Wiki group here on campus and with the Department of Natural Resources is the temperature of streams in the spring is vastly different than it was just 25 years ago, and that has a lot to do with reproductive success of various species of game fish. So there's a big impact for these things.
Wanda from Marshfield has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Wanda. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah. I was just gonna tell you about that ELF project. That came from Clam Lake, Wisconsin.
Clam Lake. That's right.
Yeah, Clam Lake, and the elk are in Clam Lake there also. But as I was waiting, I came up with a question. What do you think about the future of, like, in February? What does that look like, the beginning of February for weather? Because I'm an avid sturgeon spearer, and what I'm gathering, the ice isn't good at all. And then maybe you could put out a warning there for some of these people that are going to probably try to drive their vehicles. And, if the ice ain't going to be good.
No. Yeah. In the southern part of the state, you know, about 5 to 10 days ago, there was some signals in some of the medium to longer range forecast panels that we were really going to get a pretty decent cold wave in the first part of February. And that looks like it is not going to materialize quite to the degree that was at least a week ago. That doesn't mean it won't. But really, even if it does, you get yourself to about Valentine's Day in February, and at least in the southern part of the state, the ice starts to erode pretty fast after that because the sun angle just gets so high. And it's hotter and hotter at high latitudes to produce new pockets of really cold air, and so the chances of a big outbreak that would sustain the ice from about February 7th on just goes down really fast. So, and I'd say from here until the 1st or 2nd or 3rd of February, there's no chance the ice is really going to be made stronger.
Thicker, yeah.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. So it's a bad season. Mm-hmm.
So, but did you say it may get colder?
Yeah, there was something in the forecast progs at medium range about 5 to 10 days ago that made it look like that for the second week of February. But now that's kind of been pulled back a little bit. I wouldn't say that it's out of possibility, but it looks less likely than it did.
Yeah. Well, in about a week, we'll have the real forecast for the coming winter.
Yeah, that's right. February 2nd.
February 2nd. Yeah. We'll know.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. Well, yeah. I thought we already had it in our annual publication.
Well, see, that's just another reason why the publication is suspect. It relies on updates from a squirrel. It's just not sustainable as a science model.
Oh, my goodness. Well, have you been studying the ground? No, you probably haven't been studying groundhogs. What research are you guys working on right now?
Well, can I just say one thing about that? It's very interesting. I've been really interested for a number of years in the aerial extent of the cold pool. I bring it up in our article and on the radio once in a while. The climatological peak for the Northern Hemisphere happens to be February 2nd. Okay, so that's
Get out of here, right?
That is the day when the aerial extent of the cold air in the lower troposphere is usually at its largest. So the squirrel, of course, is not going to tell us anything we need to know. But it's still an interesting subject. It appears that the temperature contrast in the lower troposphere is weakening noticeably in the last 25 years, and the midpoint of the band of intense temperature contrast has moved toward the pole. So it's not only weakening, but moving poleward. And this is all consistent with other surface-based signals. Yeah. So that's kind of neat.
Dave in La Crosse has something for us. Dave, you got a quick question.
Hi. Yeah. Today is the 200th anniversary of the discovery of Antarctica. And I just discovered a website, a good one, called antarcticglaciers.org, which gives a lot of good information on glacial conditions and the future implications of some of those. It's one where you can write in and talk to a scientist, and there's just a multitude of questions that have been answered already, and I think it's good information.
What's the website?
AntarcticGlaciers.org.
Glaciers.org.
Only 200 years ago they discovered that. Just
I didn't know that.
Seem very long.
Yeah.
1810? 1820.
Yeah. Missouri Compromise. Imagine that.
Isn't it? Wow.
Wow.
Thank you, AntarcticGlaciers.org. We got time for Mike from Kokana. Mike?
Hello.
Hi. Quick question?
No, I have a comment. A lady called 3 or 4 calls back about a phenomenon she saw in the sky, in a large halo, and I have seen the same thing a few years ago up and off the coast of Bayfield in Lake Superior. It was a very bright, sunny day. The sky was very blue and clear, and this halo was gigantic. It did not surround the sun. Mm. It was in the middle of the sky, and it stayed there for 10 or 15 minutes. It was the most awesome thing I've ever seen.
That's cool.
Did you get a photo?
I looked it up on the internet, and it was called a sun dog.
That's
a sun dog. I'm still going to bet it's a tangential arc.
Me too, because you'd see two probably, unless there was just not very much cirrus on the other side or something.
Yeah, and that would be right on the right. And sun dogs often don't get that rainbow distribution of colors. Mm. You often see the reds, but you often don't get the blues because they mix together.
That makes sense.
So hard to know.
It's like, see the picture.
Yeah, I know. It'd be great to see it, but I wish I'd seen the same thing. Well, sounds awesome.
We're going to have to wait till the last Monday of February to talk some more about it. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it very much. Always fun to have John Martin and Steve Ackerman with us, our weather guys. They'll be back the last Monday of February, and we'll do it all over again with them. Tomorrow at this time, we'll get some expert advice from our pet care guest. Look forward to that. And introduce you to a new, we'll talk about introducing a new dog to your home. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.